All right. Thank you. So, to start tonight's class, this is the fourth class in our foundational teaching series. And it's on the Four Noble Truths. They're just about the most foundational, fundamental Buddhist teaching that there is. So, hopefully, if you're not that familiar, you will learn something, and if you are very familiar, hopefully you'll still learn something. So what I thought I would do is, I don't know, generally speaking, when you're giving a talk or you're giving a class, the rule is like, don't read stuff, right? But I thought I would take a risk and read the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is from the Pali Canon, the Buddha's first sermon. And it's not that long, and it's from an oral tradition, so it's meant to be said out loud as well. So I just thought it would be cool to, I mean, that not only does he present the Four Noble Truths in this, but I think it's just, I think it's good for us to know, even if we're just wholehearted zennies, to know, this is like the start of our spiritual lineage. What does it sound like? What did the Buddha supposedly say? I mean, of course, we don't know, is this word for word what he said, but this is our religion's mythology, right? This is like, this is like the story of Jesus in the manger. This is Moses getting the tablets from on high. This is where it all begins. So, this is also the setting the wheel of Dhamma in motion, Sutta. So I have heard, and when you hear I have heard, that means this is the disciple Ananda has recited this after the Buddha's passing, that he heard all of this stuff. So most suttas start with this, thus have I heard. I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying at Varanasi in the game refuge at Isipatana. There he addressed the group of five monks. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. Which two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects. It's base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable. And that which is devoted to self-affliction or extreme asceticism. Painful, ignoble, unprofitable. Avoiding both extremes, the middle way realized by the Tathagata, the one who has attained the highest spiritual goal. Producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding or nirvana. And what is this middle way realized by the Tathagata? That producing vision, producing knowledge leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. Precisely this eightfold noble path. Right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata. That producing vision, producing knowledge leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. Now, this, monks, is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha. Aging is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are dukkha. Association with the unbeloved is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is dukkha. In short, the five clinging aggregates, that is physical form, sensation, feeling, mental fabrications, and consciousness when we cling to them, are dukkha. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination of dukkha. The craving that makes for further becoming or continued existence, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now, here, and now there, that is craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha. The remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the way of practice, leading to the cessation of dukkha, precisely this noble eightfold path, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of dukkha. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This noble truth of dukkha is to be comprehended. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This noble truth of dukkha has been comprehended. Similarly, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of the origination of dukkha. This noble truth of the origination of dukkha is to be abandoned. And this noble truth of the origination of dukkha has been abandoned. Similarly, this is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha. This noble truth of the cessation of dukkha is to be directly experienced. This noble truth of the cessation of dukkha has been directly experienced. Similarly, this is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha is to be developed. And then this noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha has been developed. And monks, as long as this, my three-round, 12 permutation knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths as they have come to be, as long as this was not pure, I did not claim to have directly awakened to the right self-awakening, unexcelled in the cosmos with its deities, Maras and Brahmas, with its contemplatives and Brahmins, its royalty and common folk. But as soon as this, my three-round, 12 permutation knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths, as they have come to be, was truly pure, then did I claim to have directly awakened to the right self-awakening unexcelled in the cosmos, with its deities, Brahmas and Maras and Brahmas, with its contemplatives and Brahmins, its royalty and common folk. Knowledge and vision arose in me. Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. There is no further becoming. That is what the Blessed One said. Gratified, the group of five monks delighted at his words. And while this explanation was being given, there arose to Venerable Kandanya the dustless, stainless Dhamma eye. Whatever is subject to origination is subject to cessation. And when the Blessed One had set the wheel of Dhamma in motion, the earth devas, the godlike beings in the earthly realm, cried out, At Varanasi, in the game refuge at Isipatana, the Blessed One has set in motion the unexcelled wheel of Dharma that cannot be stopped by Brahman or contemplative, Deva, Mara or God, or anyone in the cosmos. Upon hearing the earth Deva's cry, the Devas of the four kings heaven took up the cry, the Devas of the 33, as well as Devas in all the other heavenly realms, including the Yama Devas, the Tushita Devas, the Nimarati Devas, the Parinimita Devas, the Devas of Brahma's retinue, took up the cry. At Varanasi, in the game refuge at Isipatana, the Blessed One has set in motion the unexcelled wheel of Dhamma that cannot be stopped by Brahman or contemplative, Deva, Mara, or God, or anyone at all in the cosmos. So in that moment, that instant, the cry shot right up to the Brahma worlds, and this 10,000-fold cosmos shivered and quivered and quaked, while a great measureless radiance appeared in the cosmos, surpassing the effulgence of the Devas. Then the Blessed One exclaimed, "So you really know, Kandanya? So you really know?" And that is how Venerable Kandanya acquired the name Anya Kandanya, Kandanya who knows. That's it. So you just don't hear the second part about all the gods going off and the radiance permeating the cosmos and all that. But obviously in terms of mythology, this is a really big deal. You know, this is the wheel of Dhamma that can never be stopped. And part of the mythology of it was that on the eve of his enlightenment, you know, as he was just about to break through to this whole way of untangling ourselves from suffering, it was the Deva Mara who came and tried to like discourage him and scare him and see doubt in him and whatever and prevent him from awakening, because Mara is the Deva of the desire realm and didn't want people to be able to escape from the desire realm. He wants people to stay in the desire realm. So, the essence of the Buddha's teachings is this Four Noble Truths. Before I go on, any thoughts or reactions to our first sutta?
Yeah. Just a question about time. How long after the Buddha's, you know, death was this actually written down? Do we have a sense for that?
Well, I'm not an expert on the oral tradition. You know, to me, I think like, oh my God, they didn't write it down and they just remembered it verbally. Like, but from what I hear, it was a very reliable system. Like it was, you might as well have been writing it down. So according to the mythology, it was very soon after the Buddha's death, like, I don't know, like days or months or whatever, that the main disciples got together and decided what, and Ananda just recited these things because he had a eidetic memory,
right.
And that they kind of established this, yes, indeed, that is what the Buddha said. And so.
So it wasn't some, you know, 500 years or 50 years.
I mean, it was close to 500 years later before they wrote it down. I don't know why. There was writing in certain places in the world earlier than that, but it didn't get written down until slightly first century BC.
In oral tradition, I'm struggling with that,
I guess. Yeah.
In an oral tradition, is there some mechanism or habit or procedure within that causes the information to stay pretty static?
I don't know. Does anybody?
I think the Greeks did, so I would assume that the Indians did.
Yeah,
because
I believe
Greek was oral tradition until about that time, and I think that there's a certain distrust of writing. So writing was probably in India long before they wrote it down. Because
That's not really right to write this down. This is the proper way to present it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I wish I should look into the details, but I think, you know, people were trained, and they were trained in parts, and they learned parts of the canon and had corroborating versions and yeah.
Probably because groups memorized it and chanted it and remembered it too.
Yeah.
And woe to the one that got it wrong.
I mean, does anybody I don't know, does anybody find this kind of this tone kind of surprising? Like, didn't really know that that was part of this whole lineage. This is definitely not only, I mean, it's very different than the Zen presentations, but it's also different than, you know, kind of modern Buddhist, like, what does this mean to your daily practice kind of, you know, presentations. It's definitely, you know, as you read it, I mean, this was cutting out a lot of the repetition in oral traditions, you know. They would have said every single one of those phrases, every single phrase.
Oh, we have polycanon, that little book back there. And yeah, it's pretty repetitive.
Even the Lotus Sutra. In the Lotus Sutra, there's chapters where they're like, here it is in prose, and now we're going to do it again.
Yeah. So, starting with dukkha. Now, we talked a little bit about dukkha last week, but in a different context this week. So dukkha can be translated as suffering, dissatisfactoriness, stress. So it's frequently translated as suffering, but that's not that. I mean, it can be suffering, but it's not necessarily how we feel like our definition of suffering. Dis-ease even sometimes. I mean, so sometimes this can be acute and sometimes it's kind of subtle. As we talked about last week, this arises because of anicca and anatta, because of impermanence. Everything is constantly changing, and coupled that with a sense of we're always looking for something to grasp. We're always looking to something to identify with, something to make ourselves feel safe, something to define ourselves, and we do that, and then everything's impermanent. So everything's kind of dissatisfying. So it's like these three marks, you know, arise together. And I really loved this. I found this definition of dukkha. It's actually, you know, like a footnote to a translation of the Bhagavad Gita or something like that. But it says, it is amusing to note, this is Winthrop Sargent, it is perhaps amusing to note the etymology of the words sukha, my dog's name, pleasure, comfort, and bliss, and dukkha, misery, unhappiness, pain. The ancient Aryans who brought the Sanskrit language to India were a nomadic horse and cattle breeding people who traveled in horse or ox-drawn vehicles. Su and du are prefixes indicating good or bad. The word ka, in later Sanskrit meaning sky, ether, or space, was originally the word for hole, particularly the axle hole of one of the Aryans' vehicles. Thus, sukha meant originally having a good axle hole, while dukkha meant having a poor axle hole, leading to discomfort. So I just love that image of like, like this is just like that's what dukkha is, you know. It's not like, oh, it's suffering, life is suffering. It's just life is uncomfortable. Life is just kind of inherently uncomfortable. So the second truth is the origin, the cause of dukkha. And it turns out that dukkha is not caused by external things, but by our craving for them to be otherwise. So, for example, we resist the existence of unpleasant or painful things, and we want pleasant things to last. And this is like, I think is important. What most people, it makes sense for most people if we think of this in terms of pain versus dukkha, physical or emotional pain versus dukkha, that there's a difference. That there is, you know, that list of things that the Buddha said were dukkha, you know, birth and death and loss and, you know, losing the things you love and having to deal with things you don't love and da da da, is dukkha. But I mean, in a way, that's like, that's what it leads to dukkha. Those are the things we encounter that cause the discomfort and the dissatisfactoriness. But the idea is we can experience these things. But we add something to them. So there's a really sweet little sutta in the Pali Canon called Two Arrows. And it describes how, you know, a disciple of the Buddha, you know, you've got physical pain or emotional pain or something happens. And, you know, it's like you've been hit with an arrow and it hurts. Now it said, you know, the ordinary person is like, oh no, oh no, I got struck by an arrow. They're like, you know, how did this happen? Oh my God, am I going to die? You know, like all this other stuff. And they said, that is like, now it's like you've been struck with a second arrow. All of that is like a second arrow. Where it says, the disciple of the Buddha basically says, the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, when touched with a feeling of pain, does not sorrow, grieve, or lament. Does not beat his breast or become distraught. So he feels one pain, physical but not mental. And I would say he could feel emotional pain of a certain kind, but not the extra piece that we add. So I'll go more into that later. So this isn't just life is suffering. As, you know, people who are unfamiliar with Buddhism, they'll probably say, like, oh, you're going to a Buddhist center? Oh, really? Just like life is suffering, you know? It's like, life isn't just suffering. You know, the experience of dukkha is inherent in our being human, but the whole point of Buddhism is there's something you can do about it. Life doesn't have to be marked by dukkha. So the third noble truth is the cessation of dukkha, that it's possible to let go of our desire and resistance, our craving for things to be other than how they are, in order to experience this freedom from dukkha, to avoid that second arrow. So even in the face of real pain, difficulty, loss, a significant amount of relief can be found by letting go of our desire for things to be different. And the fourth noble truth, of course, is the practice leading to the cessation of dukkha, the Eightfold Path, which that will be next class. Because we're generally not able to just let go of our desire for things to be different. I mean, maybe sometimes, but, you know, it's usually not a sheer act of will. Like, it actually takes some work. It actually takes some practice for us to learn how to use our minds to appreciate what's going on, to let go of attachments. So the Eightfold Path is what we do to help that. The how. And so, just a note before we go into a little more, what are we supposed to do with the Four Noble Truths? Now, the way that they're stated like that, the Four Noble Truths, it sounds like a little catechism, and you should just like, all right, you know, I accept as a Buddhist that life is marked by dukkha. I accept that it is caused by desire. I accept, you know, like you just, you know, accept them, believe them, whatever. But the way, you know, like in that sutta that we read, the Buddha talks about, you know, there's that part. So he's already said what the Four Noble Truths are, but then he says, now, you know, as I was gaining this insight, what I saw is this is the noble truth of dukkha. And then this noble truth of dukkha is to be comprehended. So it's kind of like the first part is like, you know, I for us, it would be like, well, I heard there's this noble truth of dukkha, okay. And then really seeing, like, I need to really understand this for myself, and then investigating it, and then this noble truth of dukkha has been comprehended. That is where the insight and liberation comes, is where, oh, and this isn't just, this isn't a general sense in our life, but it's also in each specific sense. Every time we encounter dukkha, it's like recognizing it. All right, what's going on? Oh, I'm feeling some dukkha. And that's that first step. This noble truth is the origin of the origination of dukkha, the cause. Where is this coming from? And understanding that this cause, now when we see this cause, the cause needs to be abandoned. And then it's abandoned. So part of this process is, you know, we actually have to see what's causing our dukkha. And each circumstance, it might be different. Nobody can really tell us. What are we holding on to? What is extra? What's causing it? And then, if we want to follow this path of liberation, I mean, we can hold on to it if we want. But if you do want to follow the path of the Buddha, then we have to abandon it. And then the third truth is the cessation of dukkha, and to directly experience it. So he didn't have that insight until he had directly experienced that cessation of dukkha. So when we directly experience, we let go of this attachment, you know, and really actually experiencing that this is a good thing. There was some relief in this. You know, this is, you know, to encourage us to do that again and again. And then the last one is this noble truth of the way of practice is to be developed. And then the insight comes when this has been developed. So this isn't just, you know, knowing the truth, accepting the truth. It is comprehending, abandoning the sources of dukkha, directly experiencing how this whole process goes, and developing the Eightfold Path. So we have to investigate these things within our own experience, verify them, actualize them for ourselves. And even just in that first step, it can be hard to admit dukkha sometimes. I mean, it depends on who you are and where you are in your life. I mean, sometimes you can, yeah, I'm in the middle of dukkha, definitely. I am suffering, I am dissatisfied. And we may long for that to go away. And sometimes we may not feel a lot of it at the moment, but we just have this foreboding sense that it'll come, that it'll eventually come. We'll lose things, we'll get old, we'll get sick, whatever. And so there's a certain kind of anxiety present, even if we're not suffering a lot at the moment. But when when things are going pretty well, we kind of take pride in being competent, in being, especially, you know, one of the traps of spiritual practice is like, come on, I've been a Buddhist for 10 years, shouldn't be feeling like this, you know? So after a while, then it becomes, in a way, even harder to admit that, like, I'm not feeling great, I'm kind of stuck. Pierce myself with this second arrow here. So to recognize, and in a way, it's that turning inwards as well. I think first of all, we're just like, you know, noticing how everything sucks out there. Like, all right, I think I've got a little bit of, you know, stuff going on. And then investigating that origin of dukkha with this, you know, the two arrows. And this is, you know, sometimes it's easier to observe in other people than it is in ourselves. But one example that kind of helps illustrate it to me is to imagine, you know, let's say somebody loses their home to a fire, something that seems very real these days. And that can be a very traumatic thing, and, you know, could lead to lots and lots, you know, financial difficulties and all kinds of real pain, you know. And you could imagine someone, you know, experiencing that, struggling, getting bummed, needing some support from friends, you know, but kind of just doing their best to just get through it and coming out the other side and whatever. But you can also imagine someone, you know, this completely ruining their life, that this is just so devastating, and how did this happen, and now I can never trust that anything can be good again, and, you know, it'd be very easy to make something like that into a very, you know, a object of resentment and sadness and longing from which you never recover. So there's a lot with practice can't, unfortunately, insulate us from the pains of life, but it can make it much more likely that we can make our way through these things without it completely breaking us. And then what we're doing in a certain sense is acceptance. I mean, the Buddha doesn't talk about it in those terms, but in kind of modern terms, it's acceptance of things as they are. And I think it's really important to look at acceptance as being that's about the past and the present. Things happened, led up to here. Here we are. Things may not be the way we want them, but like wishing it were otherwise is not going to change it. It just completely pointless and just tears us up inside. But that does not say anything about what happens from here on out. So it is not an acceptance of this situation, therefore I'm not going to do anything about it. Actually, real acceptance frees us up to take positive action. So it's not acceptance. The acceptance has nothing to do with the future, I guess would be a short way to put it. This isn't so easy, of course, so that's why we have the Eightfold Path, which I will go into in detail next week, but just to kind of give you an overview. So you often hear the Eightfold Path, like was in that translation of the sutta, right view, right resolve, right speech, right. And this isn't right as opposed to wrong. This isn't right as opposed to the good versus bad, you know. It's right as in, like, that's the right key for that door. You know, that's the one that works. So this is like another, I like to kind of use the word appropriate sometimes. This is, so, you know, it's the view that works. It's the resolve that works to take you to liberation, not, you know, what's right versus wrong. So in terms of the Eightfold Path, then there's appropriate view or understanding. If you can see things clearly, you can act appropriately and know how to avoid suffering and bring about happiness. And in particular, right view is really understanding those Four Noble Truths, personally, direct experience of that whole process. Appropriate resolve or intention. So intention drives everything. If it's not your intention to end your dukkha, to begin with, you won't get very far. So we have to continually strengthen and refine our resolve and intention. Appropriate speech. So I think this is so profound. Buddhist practice isn't just about your mind. It's also about your behavior and your body and how you act. What we say profoundly affects the way we think, vice versa. Communication has consequences. Appropriate action is the next one. So just as speech has actions. So this is moral behavior, essentially. appropriate livelihood, how we make our way in the world. And I think in modern terms, you know, this goes well beyond just, you know, how we make our money day to day, but how we make our way in the world, how we buy things and how we participate in that, in our culture. Then there's appropriate effort. If we don't apply energy and diligence to our practice, it won't go anywhere. Appropriate mindfulness. So that's clear, that's learning to put our minds on the appropriate thing, what is going to lead to greater wisdom and understanding. So I think of it as like, if you had a pair of binoculars, mindfulness is the ability to like get what you want in the viewfinder and keep it there, you know, and then we'll kind of go like this. Okay. Oh yeah. Okay. Right. I wanted, because we're not going to develop any clarity about said thing unless we can keep it in the viewfinder. So it's kind of like learning how to direct the mind toward what is helpful. And then finally, appropriate concentration or meditation. So there's a certain way that the subtler aspects of these things, what's going on within our senses of self, our senses of attachment, are very difficult to perceive unless we do that in the stillness of meditation. So there you have the Eightfold Path real quick. In terms of the Four Noble Truths, any questions or comments?
Can you talk about right concentration just a little bit more? So we're in your description of it, I understand concentration to mean meditation.
Yeah. So I think the term in the Pali actually is jhana, which is synonymous with meditation, meditative absorption.
Okay. A little crash refresher on the first three noble truths. That if you rake your leaves and you break out on Saturday, and you go out with the tarp and the little barrel and the rake, and you think, well, what's the right way to rake these leaves? There's way more than I can rake in a work practice period. Do I rake a large area badly because it always takes multiple passes? Do I rake a small area really well? Does the answer change knowing that there's still leaves that are going to be falling? Does it change knowing that some other schlub is going to be out here raking leaves on Monday? It's his work practice. What do I want to leave him? Going round and round. What's the right way for me to rake these leaves? At some point you go, you only got an hour, just rake leaves.
The Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, it's a complete practice. Correct me if I'm wrong, but this is what Theravada Buddhism focuses on. And I can see why you could spend your whole life digging through this in lots of contexts. It's a good example.
And it also, I mean, I'm not a Theravadan Buddhist, but, you know, done enough study to appreciate how it's also like a, if a fractal's the right word, but it's kind of like, all right, you've got the Four Noble Truths, and the Fourth Noble Truth is the Eightfold Path, and the first part of the Eightfold Path is right view, which is understanding the Four Noble Truths, and then you have like part of the Eightfold Path is right concentration, and then there's like the seven factors of right concentration, and so each of these like folds out into like a list of six and of the list of five, and a, you know, and right mind, there's the four foundations of mindfulness, so there's a whole like whole practice for developing mindfulness, and the four foundations of mindfulness are learning to become mindful of the body, learning to become mindful of the feelings, like, dislike, and indifference, and mindful of mind states, and then mindful of essentially the central aspects of the Dharma, including the Four Noble Truths. So, you know, you kind of keep on looping on back.
I did that all without writing it down.
Yeah.
I suspect somewhat of it, all those lists are, that's one of the ways they remember
things. Yeah.
I recited those.
It would be very fascinating to know why does repetition help? I guess. I mean, you can almost sound kind of musical, like, you know, that, like, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose. No, you know, just like, kind of like we learned the ABCs, you know? Like, okay.
A lot of ancient cultures have, it's a point of status to be a recorder or to be the one reciting. So there were a lot of checks on people who had that position. So, but when you just now mentioned how it kind of mathematically breaks down, I see it kind of one of those unfolding puzzles, you know, when you flick it, it's like a big fan.
Yeah.
It opens up, and thank you for that word appropriate, for instead of the word white.
Yeah.
I see it like navigating, like sailing, you know, find your way. But we live in modern times in such a binary kind of, is it this or is it that? Yes or no, rather than both. And I mean, we can be in dukkha and say, okay, this is happening, distance, step back, and right now I'm flummoxed, or I'm, but because humans, life gets messy, so we're not like a quick switch.
Well, we learn how to sit with it. You know, but caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering. Believing self-centered thoughts, exactly a dream. Experiencing life without the self, the path of liberation. Being just this moment, compassion's way. You ever heard of this?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's why. This was from my experience in the former Zen
Center. You guys recited it regularly, right?
Yes, after every session. And get out of yourself. Self-centered.
So anybody, I mean, do you all feel like you've got a handle on recognizing dukkha?
Sometimes. Easier than recognizing others than yourself.
Let's wake up to it. Some people are awake to the suffering.
It seems to be some of us less prone to that sort of suffering and others more prone. We all have our aches and pains. Some people really get stuck on it and dwell on it, and others with the same level of pain. Accepted. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, I like the... I don't literally believe in rebirth or reincarnation. I mean, I guess you could say I'm agnostic. I mean, I can't prove to you that it doesn't happen, but I'm skeptical, you know. but I do like the mythology of it, if you will. Like, there's a certain, I think for many good mythologies, it's like, it's as if it's true, and in a way it doesn't matter if it's literally true, but it's as if. And that's one of the things in terms of the different proclivities that, you know, the way that the Buddhist idea of the rebirth accounts for that is, you know, well, stuff happened in past lives, right? If you find yourself with a, you know, a character of mind and body or whatever that, you know, is a little stronger, more resilient or whatever, you know, that's good fortune, and that you maybe you did some work in previous lives or something like that, and that somebody else may be in a different place on the path, and they have some other things to learn in this lifetime. For me, it's kind of a convenient way to like skip the judgment. and then, you know, and the same applies to us too. We end up with shortcomings and karma and stuff that we really wish we didn't have to deal with, but you know, here it is.
Well, that's what I meant. Some of us are in denial. We won't face things.
Yeah. Well, and there's, you know, and sometimes we don't want to face things with good reason, because, frankly, it can be scary. I mean,
yeah.
That's one of the things I think is beautiful about practice, that if you can build up faith in practice, and maybe not just Buddhist practice, whatever practice you have, you build up some faith that essentially you can handle it and you can turn it around.
That's right.
That, then you have more courage to face it. Mm-hmm. When, you know, before that, I mean, before I got into Buddhism, I was just like, I don't know what to do with this stuff. Like, why face it? I don't have any answers for it. I don't have anything that I can do about it. Like, I feel sad or miserable, and, you know, why would I, you know, there's no point in acknowledging that unless you're just going to wallow in it. Whereas the Buddhist, you know, approach is so different. It says, no, look at it, it'll be okay. That's just the beginning. Like, you learn to understand it, and then you can transform it. And once you find that you can do that, then it's, yeah, makes all the difference. Do we have any testimonials for facing dukkha and coming through? I mean, I gave one a week ago Sunday or something in my Dharma talk, of just saying I'd been really bummed about some setbacks. I'm getting involved with a climate activist group, and I really never got a chance to, you know, take any nonviolent direct actions with them, because now there's kind of like all this, I don't know if I'd call it infighting, but they have to deal with like internal organizational stuff and addressing racism and sexism and mitigation of power and all the stuff that the critics from the outside are criticizing this group. And I was just kind of like, I was feeling really dejected, because I had put a lot of hope in this movement. Like, it seemed like the most hopeful thing that I had ever encountered in my life in this respect. And I'm like, yes. And then, you know, oh my, oh man, really? Like, that's just, and I was feeling, I don't know, discouraged. And I examined that and realized, like, there's a part of, you know, there were aspects. I always ask myself, well, what is there here that I can let go of? I mean, even if the situation is challenging or difficult, what is there that I can let go of? And I realized there was this sense of just like, I was so hopeful, and now I don't feel hopeful. So it was like, it was all about me, right? It was all about how I feel and my feelings, and like what? Like somebody deliberately did this in order to like disappoint me or something? It's just the way it is. Right. Like,
Get, you don't like the version.
Yeah, there it is. So, like, and whoever, and, you know, who said this is going to be easy? Like, who said changing the planet and stopping climate change is going to be easy? Like, I just wanted to go out there in the streets and get started right away, you know? So I just saw those extra self-centered little things that I was mixing in there. You know, this is what we call, like, self-attachment, right? We've taken something and we've attached it to our sense of self.
Yeah, it's just humans. You just bring humans together and that stuff comes out. And for me, in the work I do, it helps to pull back and try to look at the, stop focusing so much on me and then pull back and try to look at the bigger picture. Yeah. And what I tell the younger people coming into the LGBT movement these days is this is not going to be solved in your lifetime. So you just need to be okay with that right from the beginning. And continue to do the work and find satisfaction in it, but don't get so wrapped up in it that you start to burn yourself out, because this is not going away. That finding those larger strategies is really important, because yeah, I can get really balled up in it too, and it doesn't help any good, including me.
I think sometimes the problem, it sounds like your group is probably fairly consensus-based, pretty even, there's no bona fide leader. And it's strange how we can get a group of people with a common goal just headbutt each other. Mm-hmm. But then there's those leaders that show up and they just, in the end, the charismatic leader is needed. And Greta's one of them, where she can continue to accomplish. But yeah, it is frustrating. I'm in a consensus-based community, and at times it's unbelievable how much not conflict, it's just this kind of based around a
why aren't we getting anything done?
Just trying to get a task done.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you all.
Thank you.